WBGO.org.
This is Ask Governor Murphy, a WBGO News production in collaboration with WHYY and WNYC. I'm Nancy Solomon. It's the first day of congressional impeachment hearings and a week after New Jersey's statewide elections. We'll have lots to pick apart on politics, climate change, and taking the profit out of student loans. Listeners, did you vote last Tuesday? What questions do you have for Governor Murphy? Call us at 844-677-9283. That's 844-677-9283. WBGO and WHYY's State House reporter Joe Hernandez will also be taking your questions via social media. So tweet them at us with the hashtag AskGovMurphy. I'm joined in the studios of WBGO in Newark by New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy. Good to see you again.
Nice to be here, Nancy.
It's cold outside.
It is cold outside. In fact, it's caught my voice a little bit. I've got a little bit of a Lauren Bacall sound tonight, so forgive me for that.
And did you feel compelled today to start brining the icy roads?
No, because we already started in July.
Well, we may need you out there brining pretty soon if this weather keeps up.
Yeah, this is we're at the cusp. We got nailed last November, so we're trying to get as prepared as we possibly can.
So let's talk about that election last week. Democrats lost two assembly seats and one Senate seat in the southernmost district in the state. Senate President Steve Sweeney seemed to blame you for the losses. What's your take?
You won't be surprised. I don't quite see it that way. I'm the titular head of the Democratic Party. Let there be no doubt, unequivocally, I want Democrats to win, including those two assembly members and the senator. So, period. Two things. When you look at the results all over the state, including very significant wins at both county and local levels. You know, for instance, the Democrats will now have control of the Freeholder Board in Somerset County for the first time since Lyndon Johnson was president. Not just where we won, but where we competed in very red Republican assembly districts with really close races and outstanding candidates. I say if you ran as a proud Democrat and you ran on the values and you ran on the stronger and fairer New Jersey that we've been talking so much about and doing so much about, more often than not, you either overperformed, you competed very closely, or you won. I think where folks chose to not embrace those values, in some cases, folks who said they'd vote for Donald Trump for president, I think you probably got the result that you could have expected. Again, I want to bat 1,000. I'm a pig. I want to win every race up and down the state, including those in that first district. But I'll tell you, we won a lot. You look at a Morris County where I just came in from, in the communities where we've now taken control, Chatham Borough, Chatham Township, to pick two examples, all over the state in places that we wouldn't have been even talking about 5 years ago, never mind competing in, and in some cases, in many cases now, winning in.
In what ways does it matter when we talk about these local elections? So, you know, city councils and county freeholders, how does that help you push your agenda statewide?
Listen, I'm a big, the reason I was in my prior life at the Democratic National Committee was because of Howard Dean's 50-state strategy, which really had three dimensions. One is you compete everywhere, even if it's really red. And so we've got a 21-county strategy. The whole ballot counts. The bottom, and frankly, is in many cases more important than the top. And every vote counts. And on that second one, most of the connectivity, most of the intimacy of governing is going to be mayors, council, county positions. Not only did we win the freeholder control, the freeholder board in Somerset County, we now have a Democratic sheriff coming in. Look at all the debates that we've been having as a state. Look at the country's been having about how you deal with immigrant brothers and sisters. sheriffs really matter? You know, what are their values, as an example? You've now got a Burlington County Board of Chosen Freeholders, which is unanimously on the side of Democrats. That really matters. There's real governing. The state obviously plays a big role. The feds play a big role in this president, a frustrating one. But county and local races and county and local governing really matters, and they can amplify our agenda. It's not either or, it's and both.
This is Ask Governor Murphy. Listeners, did you vote last Tuesday? What questions do you have for Governor Murphy? Call us at 844-677-9283. And we do have some calls on the line. Let's go to Spencer in Jersey City. Hi, Spencer.
Hi there. Hey, Governor Murphy.
Hey, Spencer. How are you, man?
I'm doing well, thanks. I had a question. I remember when you were running that you campaigned on legalizing marijuana recreationally. I was just wondering what's going on with that. It seems like it's gone radio silent. If there's any updates.
Yep.
On that front.
Yep. Good question, Spencer. It has not gone radio silent. So we committed to two things. One is that we would open up the medical marijuana regime, and we opened that up almost from day one, and it's continued to open up. Thousands, tens of thousands, in fact, more people are now able to participate in that system, and that's changing people's lives, in some cases saving them. On adult use marijuana, we committed largely because of social justice, widest white, non-white gap of persons incarcerated in America when we came into office. A lot of that's due to low-end drug offenses. We committed to pursue that. We came very close to getting it done legislatively in March. I've got a meeting with the legislative leaders tomorrow, and that's on our agenda. I'd love to hope that we could take another shot at that legislatively over the next several months in what people call the lame duck session. I don't know who came up with that, but I hope that we can together take another shot at that. And Spencer, failing that, and I sure as heck hope we get it over the goal line, largely for social justice, I think the default will be a referendum, public referendum on the ballot next November. The problem I have with waiting, plus or minus 600 people are going to get arrested this week in New Jersey on drug-related, most of the marijuana-related offenses, and most of them are persons of color and more often than not young men of color. So the status quo with that is the reality. Our kids exposed, the drug traffickers setting the rules, making the money, lack of social justice. The status quo is unacceptable, so I'm hoping we can get this done sooner than later.
Okay, thanks for your call, Spencer. You know, on the sort of the flip side of the coin, maybe you could argue, is vaping, which you want to move in the direction of legalizing marijuana, but you're moving in the direction of trying to restrict and cut back on vaping and maybe menthol cigarettes or flavored cigarettes.
Yep.
So let's talk about that, because I think the introduction of these bills is happening right now in the legislature.
That's correct.
So one of them would ban all flavored vaping products, including menthol.
It does include menthol.
And is that, but that has nothing to do with menthol tobacco cigarettes that get smoked, right?
It doesn't, although I had a good conversation with Senator Joe Vitale a couple of weeks ago, and there is a strong movement as well to ban menthol, actual menthol cigarettes. I don't think there's an inconsistency on the marijuana and the vaping piece. I stood up a task force and gave it a maximum 3-week life, and I want to give a shout out to our Health Commissioner Judy Persicelli, who chaired that, and they came in with a set of recommendations, and we've had very good conversations with the legislative leaders since then. In the recommendations, which have a bunch on the legislative side and some on an executive action side, which we've already taken, basically fall into two categories. One is eliminating the cotton candy and these other flavors that exist completely and solely to hook young kids on these products. That's the only reason they exist. And the second set of initiatives is to enforce aggressively the under 21 reality, that this is not product in any form that someone under 21 should have access to. And I might add, that's the case. That's always been the case with any initiatives we've spoken about as it relates to legalizing adult use marijuana. This is for 21 and up. And so I'm hopeful we can make progress on both of those fronts sooner than later.
One of the bills would actually step up penalties for selling vaping products to people who are under 21.
Yes.
I just, you know, when I read that, it made me wonder, well, are we, we know that we have injustice in our criminal justice system in the way that everything gets prosecuted and handled. So is it not unreasonable to expect that maybe brown and black kids under 21 are going to end up being targeted and have penalties for buying vaping products? I mean, it gets to this, the social justice issues that you raise about legalizing marijuana. It just sort of popped out at me like, oh, this could be a way that, you know, kids end up in jail.
Well, it's the vendor in this case that's going to be the one that pays the piper, number one. And number two, we've got no choice, Nancy. I mean, the amount of illnesses and deaths, not just in New Jersey, but around the country, is jaw-dropping. Now, I know there's been a lot of research that's been aggressively at this, and vitamin E and it has been at the middle of this, but I don't think we have a choice. I literally don't think we have a choice. Menthol-flavored vaping, menthol cigarettes are disproportionately used in communities of color. My reaction to that is then the lives that will be saved will be disproportionately in communities of color. These are not reasons to not do it. These are reasons, I think, to the contrary, to take aggressive steps, particularly protecting our kids, our most precious assets. The amount of kids who are getting hooked on this and using it is just jaw-dropping.
This is Ask Governor Murphy. I'm Nancy Solomon. We are taking your calls. Give us a call at 844-677-9283 if you have a question for the governor, or you can tweet at us using the hashtag AskGovMurphy. Let's go to Joe Hernandez, who is reading your tweets. What do you have for us, Joe?
Sure. So we're getting lots of feedback about the bear hunt. Angie Mettler with the Animal Protection League of New Jersey says a lot of people are telling her they voted for you, Governor, because you said you'd stop the bear hunt. And Patty from Denville says she's glad you stopped it on state lands, but wants to know why you haven't completely outlawed the bear hunt statewide.
So, Joe, good to hear your voice. And to both women who raised this, I want to be unequivocal. In this sense, I've not changed my stripes on this. I want to end the bear hunt in this state. I want to explore all non-lethal methods available to us. I am unequivocally and passionately of that opinion. By the way, I'm told Connecticut hasn't had a bear hunt, I think, since 1848, and they appear to be doing just fine. So I don't accept the arguments that something is going to happen in our ecosystem. But I want to make sure these women and others are out there are listening. We do not have the singular sole authority by executive action to end the bear hunt. We've looked at this every which way, and I promise you we'll continue to look at it. We have, in fact, limited, as one of the callers or one of the folks raised rightfully, we've limited dramatically the amount of land that these hunts can take place on, and that's had an impact. The single most effective, and I want to say this to anybody who's listening, they could speak to their legislator. The one way that we can end this is a bill that comes to my desk, sponsored by legislators, passed by both houses, that I could sign to end this, and I would sign it. If that gets on my desk, that's a 100% guarantee I will sign it. But I need that to my way of thinking, is the singular way to end this. From the outside looking in a government, we made a lot of promises. I think the record made the point of 6 months ago that we had 52 campaign promises, and we had checked 47 of them. Today, we started the process at long last on the public bank, which I'm incredibly proud of. That took us longer just because it was more complicated once we got inside. The bear hunt of the last three or four items is the most frustrating one. I want folks to know I want to end it. We will do everything we can to end it. The best, fastest way to end it is legislation that gets to my desk that I'll sign.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We have Hugh from Bloomfield. Hugh, you're on the line with the governor.
Hello.
Hey, Hugh.
Hi, Governor.
How are you?
I'm a professor at Montclair State University.
Yep.
And currently we're working without a contract, and we've been negotiating with the Office of Employee Relations for a little bit now. And I'm wondering what your office is doing to support us and labor in AFT higher education.
Yeah, Hugh, I just had a good interaction with Donna Chiara today, you should know. And we are obviously, I hope it goes without saying, huge believers that one of the reasons why The top reason why, in fact, people come to New Jersey and stay in New Jersey is our education system, including our system of higher education. So teachers and professors, the whole village of folks who come into contact with students at all ages. We're also a big and proud organized labor state. There is no prouder organized labor state in the United States of America, and we wear that as a badge of honor. As it relates to the specifics of what you're dealing with at Montclair State, I'm not up to my eyeballs on the details, but Rob Acero Angelo, our Commissioner of Labor, is. And Hugh, with your blessing, I'm going to ask Rob to reach out to you within the next 24 hours. As usual, our whole cabinet and team are listening tonight, including Rob. Either he or one of his senior folks, I'll get him to reach out to you. Obviously, again, we are a proud labor state. We value our teachers. We value our professors. We value our institutions of higher education. We obviously want this to get to a good place. So thanks for weighing in, and I'll have Rob follow up with you.
Okay, we're going to stick with the calls. We have Sherry from Washington Township. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
Hi,
hello,
Sherry.
Governor.
How are you?
Good. I wanted to tell you that I like a number of your ideas, reducing property taxes, and your commercials are great. I think they're really sending the right message. However, what's troubling me is your unwillingness to let the women who've worked on your campaign and served on your transit team speak publicly. And I was wondering, my question is, did you or the First Lady receive any reports of a hostile work environment or sexual harassment from those women?
Sherry, first of all, thank you for your good words and encouragement in terms of the agenda. You mentioned property taxes, by the way. I'm sure we'll get to property taxes because we always do. And breaking the back of property taxes is high on our agenda. Last year was the lowest increase in the state's history, but it was still an increase. Sherry, here's a fact. Non-disclosure agreements are a part of every single campaign that I believe has probably ever been run, at least certainly every statewide or bigger campaign. It is a natural, constant, regular part of the framework in across every campaign that I'm aware of. And it's for a reason. You're trying to beat the other people. You've got approaches. You've got secrets. You may well run again. I'm in all likelihood going to run again for governor. That stuff's important. I'm not in this to finish in second place. And that's a fact. That's the way they work. And that is that's going to continue to be a fact. And we're not an exception. Trust me, we're not an exception. And I'm very proud of the culture. I'm very proud of the operation, without question, that we ran, that we run in government, and that we will run. And whenever anything is raised with us, we take it very seriously. And we will always continue to do that.
Well, in the case of the non-disclosure agreements, I mean, from what we know of the Katie Brennan case, she didn't have a non-disclosure agreement. She was able to come forward. I'm correct, right? That it wasn't an issue in her case that she couldn't speak about what had happened.
So I've just said what I'm going to say about non-disclosure agreements as it relates to Katie. I think we've also spoken volumes, and I think we've made huge strides since this happened. And we have to continue to be a survivor-centric state, whether it's how government operates, whether it's how our whole society operates. And I think we've learned lessons. We put in place a number of processes. The Attorney General, I think, deserves an enormous amount of credit for sort of resetting the entire way in which survivors are able to get back on their feet as fast as possible, as wholly as possible, and I'm very proud of that work. Are we perfect as a state? No, but I want to be at the head of the American class in this. That's our objective and nothing less.
I mean, the reason I asked is because I'm not sure if the questioner, if it came from the column that Tom Moran wrote in the Star Ledger, but he was tying together Fox News and them giving up their NDAs and your campaign, but really there hasn't been an issue. There is no question about whether there are women who haven't been able to speak.
No.
from your campaign.
I can't get inside of Tom's head. I don't know what the connection he was making or why he was making it. I know why we have had them, and that's for pure political realities. This is a cold-blooded brass knuckles business, and you have to come in first place or you might as well go home, and that's what we intend to do.
Okay, we're going to talk more politics. We're going to talk about impeachment and the announcement today about a public bank coming to New Jersey. That's all on This Is Ask Governor Murphy, and we will be right back.
You're listening to Ask Governor Murphy, a WBGO News production in collaboration with WNYC and WHYY. Got a question for the governor? Call us at 844-677-9283 or send us your questions on Twitter or Facebook with the hashtag AskGovMurphy.
I'm Nancy Solomon. We're live in Newark with Governor Phil Murphy. So today was, of course, the beginning of the congressional impeachment hearings. Now, I thought it would be interesting to talk with you about it because you worked in the State Department. You were an ambassador to Germany for President Obama. So I thought maybe you could give us an insider's view. I mean, is there a balancing act for ambassadors and career diplomats who have to pivot between the political needs of the president to get reelected and the work of the career work of foreign policy and diplomacy?
So only because I was running around chasing my tail all day doing one event after another, my health warning is I saw none of it today.
Neither did I.
Okay, so I've read you were working hard today, I know as well. So I've seen some stories, but I'll give you a general reaction. First of all, Ambassador Taylor, I never met, but he was sort of in the gods category, in the highest, most esteemed group of career diplomats. He's been around for decades, and he's an unimpeachable source and record. Folks have to understand what we're seeing is not just not normal; it is either somewhere between highly abnormal or maybe has never happened again before in our country's history. This is way out of bounds behavior. You know, so this question of settling a political score or getting political access on a potential opponent and wrapping that into a promise of security and defense aid to a country that we want to stand beside and hopefully over time draw into the European Union and closer to our orbit is completely and utterly unheard of. Remember, this is a country that was unlawfully invaded by Russia, and so we're on the right side. We're on the right side of this. We're trying to help them out, and it's just appalling. If this turns out to be true, it's appalling, and it's been corroborated now by a whole number of folks. And as you rightfully point out in your question, somebody like Ambassador Taylor and others who are witnesses or will be witnesses have served multiple administrations across both sides of the aisle. I worked with I was a political appointee, as you rightfully mentioned, in Germany, one of the largest missions we have in the world. I was the only political appointee. Everyone else was either career State Department or in some other branch of the U.S. government. Some of the finest people I've ever worked with. And to their credit, they've worked seamlessly across, in many cases, as far back in my experience with President Reagan, to President Bush, to Clinton, to Bush, to Obama, and now to President Trump. So I just think folks need to understand this is not normal. This is as far from normal as anything I think we've ever experienced.
So here's a multiple choice question. What do you find most surprising in all this? Trump's alleged behavior, the Republican support and doubling down on in supporting his behavior, or the attacks on these career State Department people, some of them, you know, there's the one guy who's the decorated war veteran.
The lieutenant colonel.
And the attacks have been vicious against these folks. So what do you find, what's the most sort of surprising thing in all of this?
I don't want to dodge an answer, and I'm not doing that. I'd say all of the above. I guess the least surprising thing, sadly, is the president's behavior. Because we're now almost 3 years into this, and his behavior is jaw-dropping in so many respects, he's probably the least surprising. I personally think the folks who are going to go to the last for him will pay a political price. And I think it's appalling what they're doing to these, as you mentioned, not just State Department, but military, Defense Department. Folks who are in government for the right reasons, trying to do the right thing. In many cases, I'll bet you if we checked out their political affiliation, they're as likely to be Republicans as they are Democrats. So it's not even one party versus another, even though that's what the president and his supporters would like you to think it is. I think it's just all awful, and I hope we get through this. I support the process, the deliberative, transparent, one step in front of the other, fact-based, because otherwise I don't think we're going to be able to bring enough folks' attention and support to this.
This is Ask Governor Murphy. I'm Nancy Solomon. We're taking your calls at 844-677-9283, or you can tweet your question using the hashtag AskGovMurphy. And Joe Hernandez, what questions on social do you have for us?
Here's one from Justin in Hoboken. He says, when are New Jersey Transit buses going to start taking either tap to pay or a smart card? New York City does this, and it's much easier.
That was Justin?
Yes.
I don't have a specific answer, but boy, sooner is better than later. NJ Transit is making enormous strides, but it's in the context, Justin, of boy, do we inherit a mess. And I'll forever not understand why it was wrecked the way it was wrecked in the last administration. Because I think when you're the densest state in the nation and you sit beside the largest market in the world in the north, and on the other side, one of the fastest growing markets in the country, it isn't Democrat, Republican, Martian, Communist. Just you got to move people around better than anybody else. And they took a whole series of volitional steps and trashed it. And that includes getting behind the curve on technology, and the tap notion is a good example of that. Justin, I'm going to ask either Kevin Corbett, the CEO of NJ Transit, or Diane Gutierrez-Scachetti, the chair, to give you a shout in the next 24 hours and give you a specific time frame. But the sooner the better.
There was a story just in maybe the last week or so that sadly a man died on a New Jersey Transit train of a heart attack. Is there discussion about whether defibrillators will be put on the trains?
There is. I don't know. I as I sit here tonight, I don't know the difficulty of the dive in terms of how expensive and how complicated, how much time that would take. But yeah, it was an awful tragedy. The NJ Transit folks, personnel did a heroic work, but they didn't have necessarily the equipment at their disposal. I don't think that's not unique to NJ Transit, by the way, but it's a wake-up call, and it's a matter of discussion without question.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Richie from Mahwah. Hi, Richie.
Hello there. Hello, Governor Murphy.
Hey, Richie. How are you?
Not too bad. And yourself?
Very well, sir.
I own an electric vehicle, and I live in a condominium association, and they are refusing to allow me to install an outlet for it.
Huh.
And currently they are threatening to fine me because I have been using a rather large extension cord. There is a bill in the State Assembly. The Senate has already passed their version of it, but it has not yet been brought to a vote in the Assembly. Can you ask Speaker Conflin if they can bring this to a vote in the end of term so that we can get this passed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to. We don't speak about specifics on bills that are not yet at our on our desk, but the concept of dramatically is the word I would use with great deliberateness to expand the electric vehicle infrastructure in the state is something we are completely supportive of, and we've been preaching for a while. I would separately, Richie, like to ask, I'm going to ask either Kathleen Frangione or Jane Cohen on my team to follow up with you to get the specifics of your situation. It sounds like, I have to say, sounds kind of crazy given the world we're living in. You'd think a condominium association would be welcoming the presence of electric vehicles. But it sounds like in your case, they're not. I'll have my team follow up with you, and I will raise this, and we will raise this with the legislative leaders as well.
So you mentioned the public bank ever so briefly in the first segment of the show, and I know you had a big announcement today. You've been we're almost at 2 years that
yes,
you've been
ma'am.
Trying to get this. You talked about it during your campaign. Explain, I don't think most people understand. Explain what a public bank is and why it would help New Jersey.
So it's funny. We were at the event today, Nancy, and we're, you know, in the middle of the second reel of the tape of the movie, and I realized, you know what, we assumed everybody there understood what we were doing, and we stepped back. So here's the simple description. You pay your taxes or your fees. The state sits on them in a bank account until they pay out their expenses. If the monies sit in community banks in New Jersey, we not only like that, we love that. We get no issue with that. However, in most cases, measured in the billions, that money sits in accounts at money center banks, a lot of them based in New York, and in many cases, foreign domicile banks with New York branches. And those banks then use your money, the deposits, to underpin their lending portfolio. And they loan out, and that's how they make money, and the spread between the loans they make on the one hand and the what they pay in deposits to us on the other hand. Nothing wrong with that. Here's the problem. 99.9% of those loans don't come back to New Jersey. They go elsewhere. And they fund really cool infrastructure projects in places like Sweden and Japan. So a public bank, which has really only been done once ever statewide in North Dakota, is a simple concept. It's a bank. The people own it. You put the deposits, again, I'm not trying to get in the hair of the community banks. We want them to be healthy. But for the money that otherwise would have been going to the money center banks, keep them in the New Jersey Public Bank and then lend into New Jersey in the areas that we've emphasized are student loans, small businesses, particularly minority and women-owned that can't get access to credit, small-scale infrastructure, affordable housing. And any study you look at will tell you that for every dollar you lend in an economy, you get X dollars back in terms of economic impact. So it's a potential big game changer. This is a multi-billion dollar reality. Without getting into the details, it's a little bit in the bear hunt category. It's a lot more complicated to put together than it looks from the outside. But today we announced that we actually finally have got an implementation board that we stood up through executive order. They have to meet within 30 days, and they have to deliver a final report of exactly the blueprint of how this is going to get done within 1 year along very specific lines. So I think it's got great potential. There are lots of folks there today across the spectrum from labor to advocates to folks who are in finance. I think it has potential, real potential and an exciting step for our economy.
I think some New Jersey residents could be forgiven, though, for being a little skeptical. Here we are in a state where our pension fund is going down the tubes and there's a certain amount of corruption in the state. I mean, what would you say to people about, like, that they can trust the state to create a new financial institution?
I want to make sure folks just want to say one thing on pensions. If you're listening out there and you're part of that system, either active or retired, I am proud to say that we made our two budgets have been back-to-back all-time record payments into that system. And these are big, bordering on $4 billion a year at this point. People have a right to be skeptical, which is also why from the get-go, we have said this has got to be not just done, but it's got to be done right. It's got to be bulletproof from all the vagaries that have sucked under so many other institutions that folks have trusted in the past. You know, we used to be a AAA bond-rated state, and over decades that was chipped at and nicked up, as an example. So it's got to be fireproof from the vagaries that have infected and touched on too many other institutions in our state, and we're committed to that. And that's part of the charge of the Implementation Board.
You're listening to Ask Governor Murphy. We're going to be talking about climate change coming up soon. Do you have a question for the governor? 844-677-9283 is the number to call. We have a caller waiting and ready, Eric from Weehawken. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hey, Eric. How are you, man?
Hi, Governor Murphy. It's great to meet you.
Likewise.
I have a question. My wife and I were recently victims of contractor fraud.
Mm.
We've lost quite a bit. Anyone who's come to look at what's been left of the wreckage that was left has said any of the work that this contractor has done will have to be redone, completely ripped out. The contractor declared bankruptcy. And the more that we share this story with people, we start realizing that almost everyone you share the story with has a friend or a family relative who's suffered the same fate. And even today in Weehawken next door, a friend of ours just sent us an article. Apparently a string of people have recently lost a great deal of money. What can we do to create a safety net to protect people from this? You'd be better off having an earthquake hit your house.
Yep.
At least there'd be insurance to help you.
Yep.
Every lawyer we've spoken to has said, you're forget it. You've lost it all.
Yeah. Well, God willing, there's a better answer than that, Eric. First of all, I could have a number of folks follow up with you, but I'm going to ask the Attorney General himself or one of his senior folks to give you a shout in the next 24 hours. And by the way, our Attorney General is, I think, the finest in the country, Gurbir Graywall. So I will ask someone from the Attorney General's office to follow up with you, Eric, on your specific situation. This is something we're not alone. New Jersey's not alone here. We've taken some significant strides on cleaning up a bad contractor behavior. We saw a whole raft of this. Anybody who's listening who's a Sandy victim will have either lived this firsthand or will have been very close to this reality over time. And you need the quick answer is you need tough law enforcement. You need a strong attorney general, and we've got it. We are this is shifting. This is in a good way. This is getting better. But there's, as Eric points out, there's still too much of it. You also see contractors. This is not Eric's issue, but another thing that we're dealing with every day where they misclassify employees to put them into a category so they don't have to pay their payments, their hourly wages and benefits at the level that they should pay. Misclassification is something that is rampant among bad apple contractors. By the way, we have a lot of good contractors. I'm not casting a pall on everybody in the business by a long shot, but the bad apples continue to be out there. Again, Eric, we are tough on them in our Department of Labor, in that instance, Attorney General, the Treasury. We're aggressive, Department of Banking and Insurance. We'll probably never get to zero, but that would be our hope. And I will have Eric, in your particular case, have someone senior at the Attorney General's office follow up with you.
I had a pretty good experience once. I had a problem with a plumber, and I wrote a letter of complaint to the State Plumbers Licensing Board.
Yep.
And I got results. I was
yep.
impressed. It wasn't certainly as big of a problem as Eric was just telling us about, but
yep.
it was a response from
yep.
our government, and I was impressed with it.
So. I don't think this will make Eric feel any better. And again, we've got a lot of really good citizen contractors. Again, I want to reiterate that this is like any group you can find. There's going to be X number of bad apples that ruin it for the rest of the group. This won't make Eric feel any better. I think New Jersey is in a much better place than a lot of other places in America. That doesn't mean we're batting 1,000. And when it happens, you don't care about what our batting average is. It happened to you. It's like a late train or a canceled NJ transit train. We're making progress. I know that. But if it's your train that's late or didn't show up, you're frustrated, and I don't blame you. We got to bat 1,000, and this is no different.
So we got just a minute here, but before we take a quick break, but you announced today that you're going to have Vice President Al Gore make an announcement with you at Liberty Science Center next Tuesday.
We are with
What's
the First
that?
Lady as well. I'm going to keep you in suspense, but it's a big announcement on the clean energy front. We're committed to that 100% clean energy economy by mid-century. The big anchors are going to be many, but wind, offshore wind, solar, community solar will be three of the big levers that we pull. Big announcement next week. Very excited to have Vice President Gore. We've known him a long time. He's a personal friend. He's a leader. We think the world of him, and we're thrilled to have him in Jersey.
Okay, thank you. This is Ask Governor Murphy.
Listening to Ask Governor Murphy, a WBGO News production in collaboration with WNYC and WHYY. Got a question for the governor? Call us at 844-677-9283 or send us your questions on Twitter or Facebook with the hashtag AskGovMurphy.
I'm Nancy Solomon, and we're coming to you live from the studios of WBGO in Newark with New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy. So we left off with a little tidbit about climate change, but let's talk about it more. Your administration is trying to get to 100% clean energy by 2050, correct?
Yep.
And so you recently rejected a new gas-generated power plant proposed for the Meadowlands, and instead you're bumping up solar and wind production. And so I thought, let's start with solar. There seems to be a little bit of a controversy, and I'm having trouble wrapping my head around what it involves exactly, but it has something to do with the incentives that are costing ratepayers, and so some people are upset about them, but the industry says if you don't keep those incentives high for solar, then we won't get a bump up in solar, and that you need the incentives to bring the companies in to build the solar. Is that a fair?
That's a fair assessment.
Our rates, you know, we're all ratepayers, right?
Sure.
And our rates are higher than say what folks in Pennsylvania are paying.
I don't know that to be sure, but I accept that if that's true. And obviously, we're very sensitive to the ratepayer here, so we are. Driving aggressively toward this 100% goal by mid-century, but we have to do it in a way that doesn't take it out in the high to the consumer in an already high-cost state to live in, which is probably our, if you looked at how we spend our day, that's job number one for us, trying to get that good value for money equation back into balance. And so like everything else, solar has got regulations and incentives around it. Particularly when you're jump-starting a whole new sector in an industry. It's not literally new, but when you're trying to amp it up dramatically. Wind, similarly. It's a big reason, by the way, that we, assuming they're run safely, and that's job number one, that we extended the nuclear power plants' life through to their full life, because you want that. You want to get the right mix. You want the bridge that you've already got in place to allow you to develop the other industries, solar and wind in particular. I'd say wind much more significantly than solar. They're both important. And secondly, you want to do it in a cost-effective way. That's why the ratepayers have an advocate at the BPU, as they should. And that's a good balance to make sure we get that right. that we're pursuing this clean energy agenda. I think better and faster than any other American state, but not at the expense of the consumer.
When we talk about solar, are the big drivers, is it, you know, like a solar farm that's producing energy that just ends up coming to your home through your PG&E line? Or are we talking about, I know both exist, but what's the big driver of getting to the goal? Or is it getting more households to have solar panels on their roofs?
I think it's all of the above. As you know, I'm in charge of weather, so the big factor here is more sunshine. So if you could please help me out on that front. But it's all of the above. And a particular element that we are focused on is community solar, bringing solar to communities that otherwise wouldn't be natural solar targets. And those are typically going to be urban communities, multifamily dwellings, where you may not, you know, if you're on the 14th floor in a high rise in Newark, you might not otherwise have access to it. But community solar basically means taking a almost a joint asset, and then that power goes out to places that otherwise wouldn't have access to solar. Particularly, again, I'll use Newark as the example, particularly when you've got asthma rates among the kids, particularly in the wards and neighborhoods that border on the ports with the truck traffic in and out. That's a big part of our environmental justice program. So that's one thing I want to say with passion. When we think about the environment, rightfully we should think about clean water, open space, and we do. But let's not lose our focus on the environmental justice communities.
And so now, okay, let's talk about wind. So you have greenlit the largest wind power project in the country.
Yes.
So tell us about that. And this is offshore wind.
Yep.
Will we see it at all from any point along the shore?
Yeah, there are renderings. It's way offshore. So you'll see, really, these are specs. And it is significant. So you've got, at present, and I want to do more, by the way, and we want to do more. At present, you've got three tranches, one of which has already been bid out. It's the decisions have been made, and it's in process. That was 1,100 megawatts. And then there'll be another 1,200 megawatt solicitation next year and another 1,200 megawatt solicitation in the year 2022. This is a big deal. So you won't ruin your horizon. These are really literally specs. It's enough to power, I believe, the 3,500 megawatts, if my memory serves me, combined will be enough to power 1.5 million homes in our state, which is a huge amount. Yeah. And by the way, if that weren't enough, it's a great job spinner, particularly organized labor, which is the jobs. We'll take all those. We'll take as many as we can get all day long. So it's a win-win-win.
I feel like every day I run into someone that I know who tells me that they've gotten a job with Ørsted, which is the Danish company that's the wind provider that you're contracting with.
You bet.
I think it makes sense to me. And I have to say, I'm really interested in this company, Ørsted. This was a Danish company. It was called the Danish Oil and Natural Gas Company until 10 years ago or so.
Even more recently, it was called, then changed to DONG, right. D-O-N-G, I believe, was its name when I met them.
So they made a commitment to convert to renewable energy from oil and gas. And I read today that they're going to be at 96% of producing renewable from everything, all their output, by 2023. That's before we're even going to get to the $15 minimum wage.
Yeah.
So I just think it's so interesting that a Danish company is doing this, and now they've got the contracts all up and down the coast.
Yeah.
It makes business sense to me. I don't understand why Shell and Exxon, like, why aren't American, maybe Shell isn't American, but why aren't American oil companies doing this?
So, good question. Particularly offshore, Scandinavian and German firms have tended to dominate the reality there. They just got to offshore. I was the U.S. ambassador, as you mentioned earlier, in Germany. Wind power onshore and offshore is part of the landscape. So while I said that these are specks on the horizon, if you haven't driven by one that's onshore, they are ginormous.
Yeah.
But the technology, the volume in this industry has been a North Sea, Baltic Sea, reality offshore. And that's, you know, just by nexus, geographic nexus, that's been a lot of the Scandinavian players and Germans. The good news is it is spreading. Orsted's a very good company, but they're not the only ones. Folks are embracing it and beginning to realize, hey, wait a minute, there's a big opportunity here. And I should say one other thing. California's got a bigger coastline than the Jersey Shore, that's for sure. But we've got something they don't have, which is why this is going to be such a big part of our energy future. And that is when you look at the shelf underwater, ours comes down and levels off, and it levels off for many, many miles out to the well beyond the point that we need to plant the turbines, the towers and the turbines. California goes off precipitously. So there's now a new technology that's being developed for places like California where the bases actually float. That's hard, though. It's more expensive. Yeah, it's harder, and it takes longer. The great news for us is we've got a natural underwater reality, which is going to allow us to get up in business faster, less complicated, and more cost efficient.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know anything about that. Okay, so let's go back to the calls. We have James in Trenton. Hi, James.
Hi there. Yeah, good evening, Governor.
Hey, James.
Anyhow, I think my voice is a little bit hoarse, too. Anyhow, basically, I have an honest question. There's no spin to it. Anyhow, I was reading in the news about the governor's mansion hiring a new chef and earning $40,000 more than the old chef, and I'm not making light of that. Even with the added duties, I'm just wondering, just your general opinion. Like I say, I'm not knocking it. Is it worth $110,000 a year?
Yeah, so there, James, it's a good question, and your voice sounds better than mine, by the way, so whatever you're doing, I should learn from. There are two positions, and there always have been at Drumthwacket, which is the governor's mansion now for the past number of decades, a home that, by the way, was built in 1835, so it is not an easy lift in terms of making sure it stays in shape. One position is a chef, and the other position manages the operation. In fact, the chef is more experienced and is doing more and is going to cost a little bit more than his predecessor. The other house manager or property manager is also going to do a little bit more, and she is costing less than the last person in that position. So when you add the two positions together, it's a net of much less than the $40,000. But here's the bigger answer. The State House has been closed since a few months before Governor Christie left. That won't open if we're lucky for another 3 years. I'm not saying it didn't need repairs, but there's no place to go. If you're a fourth grade teacher and you want to bring your class to the State House, you can see the Assembly side and the Senate side, and they were renovated about 20-odd years ago, and they are in great shape, but there's nothing there on the governor's side. Drumthwacket, the governor's mansion, is the only place that has any majesty for this state. It's the place now. We've opened it up, and I want to give the First Lady a huge shout-out here. We've opened this place up wide for countless thousands of kids, particularly kids from communities that have been up against it for far too long, that are finally getting a chance to see this majesty and be proud of the state. You mentioned 40,000. The number is actually significantly less. Just to make sure everyone remembers one thing. The renovations on the State House, $300 million done overnight without any scrutiny. Again, I'm not saying they didn't need to be renovated, because I've seen it and it does need to be renovated. But let's get some sense of proportion here. That money, I promise you, James, is going to be really well spent. It's the people's house, and the people of the state will benefit from it.
So getting back to the State House and its renovation, when are the gold-plated toilets going to be operational?
I don't think we'll see the old gold-plated toilets, Nancy. But the current time frame is whoever the governor is, October of 2022, which will, if that's true, and God willing it is, that will have turned out to be 5 years and 4 months from the time it was closed. And again, it's pretty clear it needed some help, but the way it was done, and I said this at the time and I'll repeat it now, it's not necessarily does it need to be done, it was how it was done. Classic New Jersey, behind the curtain, $300 million, bonds raised overnight, literally under the cover of night. No one had any say except some commission that has some involvement in it, and it was done. $300 million. So I'll take the $27,000, which I think is the actual differential on the compensation. We'll get a lot of bang for that.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We have Gus, and who's calling from Michigan with a question.
Gus, my lord.
Gus, are you there?
Well, hi there. Hello. My turn?
Yeah, we don't normally get calls from Michigan on the show. So, Gus, nice to meet you.
Well, Governor, pleasure to talk to you. And I'm listening online to WVGO. So, anyways, real quick, because I know you're short on time. You guys are starting to have a problem with lead water laterals, lead-based water laterals
yep.
that are leaching lead into the water system. Now, you guys can get a college education by watching what happened in Flint, Michigan.
Yep.
Okay. Now, what happened there is that Flint was in bankruptcy, and they had the governor appointed somebody to, you know, a couple of guys to oversee everything, and they decided to go from a guaranteed water system that basically planted the same chemicals into the water
yep.
to keep the calcification of those lead service laterals.
Gus, okay? we need you to move pretty quickly to a question, please.
Real quick. I mean, I'm just making this aware to you
yep.
that if you don't watch what you're doing, you're going to end up in the same thing that Flint's got, which is basically a hazmat site.
Yep. So listen, Gus, you're great to call in. Lead service lines are a reality in New Jersey. They're a reality clearly in Michigan and America. The great thing about Newark is Newark's source is among the finest sources anywhere. We've already announced that we have a 10-year plan to replace all lead service lines in the entire state. In the meantime, in places like Newark, there is, I think, Gus, you were referring to this, there's a short-term plan which includes filters, and it included bottled water, particularly for exposed communities, exposed members of our community. The medium-term plan is sending a solution through the lines which prevents that leaching you were talking about, and that looks like it's got signs of success. In the long-term plan in Newark, they hope to do it in a few years, is to replace all the lead service lines. Access to safe drinking water is a right, not a privilege. We are committed to that. It's an American problem, Nancy. I would just say this. I wish there was a federal big water infrastructure renaissance bill that would certainly help New Jersey, but would help America as well. But we're committed to replacing all these lines. And Gus, thanks for your concern.
So the next time we see you, you will be the chairman of the Democratic Governors Association,
uh-huh.
right?
Yes.
So what are you going to focus on? I mean, this is the group of governors from all over the country. You'll be leading it. Presumably 2020 elections will be your focus. But yep. what states are you going to target, and what do you see as your role?
You bet. So real quick, I know the clock is short. I'm chair-elect and vice chair now. Three races this year, one still to come this Saturday. Louisiana. Democrats won in Kentucky, which is a great win, and we're defending in Louisiana. We've got a great governor. Excuse me. 11 races plus Puerto Rico and Guam next year. Among the big ones will be North Carolina, which will be a battleground presidential state, and it will be a battleground state again. We're defending. The key reason why do you do it? Get the New Jersey story out. We're committed to investing in the middle class and the renaissance of the middle class in our state and our country. The more models we can see out there exchanging information, best ideas, the better we are. There's always got a New Jersey nexus in everything we do for me, and this is no exception.
I had so many follow-ups that I can't get to, but thank you, Governor. That's about all we have. This is Ask Governor Murphy, a WBGO News production in collaboration with WHYY and WNYC. The show was produced by Doug Doyle with help from Eugene Son, Joe Hernandez, Alexandra Hill, Eng Santos, and Nick Pugliese. Our executive producer is Amy Niles. Our engineer is Corey Goldberg. I'm Nancy Solomon. Thanks for listening. This is Ask Governor Murphy.